I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Nicolette Han Nyman. She's author of the new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. This is such an interesting book, and you have such an interesting journey. You studied biology, you became an environmental lawyer, you became a vegetarian when you looked at the world around you, and that seemed like really the best decision. And now you're writing a book defending cattle ranching, and in fact, you married a rancher, and that's now your life's work. Tell us about the path that got you to this place.
Yes. Well, you're right. It's been an interesting journey. And as you mentioned, I grew up in Michigan, actually, and spent a lot of time outdoors and just loved nature. So I majored in biology in college. And I was already, you know, sort of passionate about environmental issues and involved in a lot of environmental issues. And I was sort of increasingly hearing that beef had a really heavy toll on the environment. And I remember in particular hearing and seeing information about the Amazon and how deforestation was mostly attributed, according to this, you know, material I was seeing, to the raising of beef cattle. And I just really felt if you're going to be a good environmental citizen, if you really care about environmental causes, you need to be a vegetarian. And I made that choice at that time, and I continued being a vegetarian for many years. I went on to law school, practiced law for about 7 years, and then began working for environmental organizations, which I did for 3 years after that. And those last 3 years of my law practice, I was working for environmental organizations, first for National Wildlife Federation and then for Bobby Kennedy Jr. at Waterkeeper Alliance in New York. And it was really Bobby Kennedy that put me on this whole path of taking a much closer look at the issues surrounding meat production, because he travels around the United States a lot and around the world, and he was encountering very severe environmental and social impacts from concentrated industrial livestock production. And he felt that it was a major environmental problem that was really not being addressed by other environmental organizations nor by the government. And for the next 2 years, I worked full-time on livestock-related issues. But during that 2 years, I was researching and visiting ranches and farms all over the country, and I was seeing both the best and the worst of what livestock production can do. And I was beginning to realize that it was a much more complicated story, that when livestock production is done badly, it has the potential to have enormous negative water contamination impacts, for example, and soil erosion and all of the things we hear about, very, you know, resource intensivity, et cetera. But on the other hand, I was visiting farms and ranches that were doing things very well. And it was looking more and more to me like the ecologically optimal way of raising, producing food of any type really involved animals. And so when I, in this job for Bobby Kennedy, when I met Bill Nyman, the founder of the Nyman Ranch Network of farmers and ranchers around the country who are all kind of grass-based farmers, when he and I got to know each other and eventually he asked me to marry him, I agreed, and I moved from New York to Northern California. Initially, I did not intend to work on the ranch because I still considered myself an environmental lawyer, definitely not a rancher, and I remained a vegetarian, and so it didn't seem to make sense to me that I would become a rancher. But I became really interested in what we were doing here, and the more time I spent on the ranch, the more I felt that our animals had very good lives and that our land was being very well taken care of and that our water was being protected. And I just became really intrigued by the whole thing. And I never ended up pursuing my legal career any further and ended up becoming a ranch hand, basically. I would say ranch hand rather than rancher because I had very few skills. I was just kind of manual labor doing really basic things at first. And that was 12 years ago. So now I have, you know, this interesting background with vegetarianism and environmental law work and now ranching work.
Now, you make the case, and I think you've been alluding to this just now, that cattle are not inherently necessarily damaging to the earth, though, as you say, they're good and bad methods of raising cattle, and we've seen both the good and the bad and real devastation here in the West. But cattle and the land on which they evolved are in a symbiotic relationship. What does that look like?
Yes. Well, it wasn't always cattle, of course, but there were always large grazing animals, and not just the grazing animals, but large predators that kept those grazing animals functioning in a certain way in the ecosystem. So I like the phrase you just used, you know, thinking it sort of in ecosystems, you know, functioning system approach rather than just looking at things in isolation. When you look more systemically like that, it becomes apparent very quickly that you have to have these large grazing animals because the globe actually had enormous numbers, huge herds of these grazing animals in prehistoric times and for millions of years. And so really the whole evolutionary process occurred in, you know, evolution does not happen in isolation, you know, for any organism, whether it's a fungi or whether it's a microscopic organism or whether it's an elephant, you know. They are always, all organisms are evolving along with other organisms that are influenced by and that they influence. And so you have a co-evolutionary process for sort of everything that exists on the Earth. And that's certainly true for grassland ecosystems. They evolved with these large grazing animals and these large predators for millions of years. And so it's now believed that the enormous bison herds that were in the Great Plains and are estimated to have been around 70 million bison at the time that Europeans first encountered them around 1800, that's believed now that that was probably just a remnant of much larger herds. Those huge caribou herds that we see in the northern parts of the Americas in the Arctic regions, that's just a tiny remnant of the caribou herds that were once in the northern regions. And even the Cape buffalo we see in Africa that remain, these are just remnants of what once covered the globe. And there were these enormous, what they call megafauna, scientists call them megafauna, these big animals, both the grazing animals and these big populations of predators, and they had enormous impacts on all the other life that was there in the soils and in the vegetation. So the argument is that cattle are actually essential to making these ecosystems function as they evolved. And when we think about this whole idea, it's essential to think in very long term, because if you just think about, you know, the last 50 years or even the last few thousand years of the Earth's history, these big animals have been gone mostly for that time period. But if you step back and look at the globe's history in a much longer-term perspective, it's apparent that these large animals and the impacts that they had were there and going on for millions of years. So that's what I'm arguing. You have to have the cattle because you don't have those big wild animals anymore.
So what is it that the cattle actually provide to the land? I mean, in your book, you talk about everything from grass to the intestinal flora of the cows. I mean, what actually is physically going on in this symbiotic relationship?
Well, it's not fully understood. There are a lot of different theories about it, but I think it's sort of believed that the main actions that they engage in that are essential to the soil organisms and to the vegetation is, first of all, the clipping that they provide through the grazing. So similar to pruning your plants in your garden, when you get rid of parts of a plant, it keeps it healthier and it stimulates that plant itself to grow more. And actually, there's a very interesting process that happens with plants when they're grazed in terms of the root structure being altered as well in a way that's favorable for soil conditions. And so just the eating of the vegetation is an important factor. And then that not only affects that vegetation itself, that individual plant, but it also affects quite dramatically the diversity of the plants that are existing in any given area. So there's actually a lot of research on this. This point is really not even disputed. There's much more diversity among the vegetation and in the soil. So the microbes in the soil are more diverse and the vegetation is more diverse when you have that grazing action. It's also believed that the hooves of the animals, the sort of the trampling that we always tend to think of as inherently negative, right? That's one thing everyone sort of automatically assumes is a negative, but that may have some really important positive impacts as well in terms of the hooves actually pushing seeds down into the soil, which helps their germination, and also it pushes vegetation down into the soil so that the biological actions that need to take place to replenish the soil's nutrients and so forth are fostered when you do that. And then finally, this whole question of the manure. So when grazing animals eat vegetation, obviously they also it comes out the other end in the form of manure, and that process actually helps the cycling of the whole system because you're sort of returning the nutrients in a very usable form, and including important microorganisms in the manure that help the soil to continue to replenish itself. It's kind of feeding the soil in a very important way. So they're sort of multiple impacts. And then I think scientists are really just beginning to fully understand this because it's much of it is about the soil biology, and it's a fairly new area of research. And even, you know, there's something called glomalin, which USDA scientists discovered just in 1996, and it's actually believed that that's one of the most essential components of the way soil functions, and especially the way it sequesters carbon. And it was just discovered in 1996. So this is really an emerging science. And glomalin is something that has been found to be the most present in undisturbed grasslands. So basically not undisturbed in terms of grazing, but undisturbed in terms of plowing. So unplowed grasslands have the highest content of glomalin, especially if they're native grasslands, interestingly enough. I think that's a very interesting twist on the whole saga. So this is kind of new thought that's emerging in the scientific community, but there's a lot of really exciting research going on that is showing why we need to have these big grazing animals.
We're talking to Nicolette Hahn-Nyman about her book, Defending Beef. Now, on your ranch, you're following the ideas and methods of Alan Savory. What are the basics of these ideas, and what does that look like in practice?
On our ranch, we are loosely following the principles that Alan Savory has set forth. And we've had, actually, the people who have managed the ranch over the years have been trained in Savory's approaches and ideas. And it's my hope that we'll do it to a greater extent in the future. We're actually part of a national park, and we're under some restrictions as far as what we're able to do, and we're in a dialogue with the Park Service about things that we'd like to do. Basically, it requires keeping the animals more densely congregated and keeping them moving more frequently. So it is actually more labor intensive. And for people that are out in very remote areas, it really requires some rethinking of, you know, how you would manage the cattle. Because currently, cattle are essentially allowed, in most situations, allowed access to large areas of land. And that is not the optimal way as far as these environmental impacts I've been talking about, the beneficial impacts. If they're more densely congregated and they're moved more frequently, their impact is more similar to the impact that they would have had historically. And also it allows more of the land to rest, because the resting is incredibly important too. You have to have both the impact and the rest. So what we do on our ranch is we do essentially rotational grazing, where the cattle are on relatively small paddocks and then moved quite frequently, and the land is rested. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to move more toward this mob grazing approach, where the cattle are more densely congregated, and we have done that historically on this ranch, and I'd like to get back to that situation again, where we're doing it, you know, a sort of a more tightly managed situation, really trying to mimic the way the wild animals functioned.
And the way the wild animals functioned was really in place because of these predators around them, like wolves, and so they really had to congregate into mobs.
Exactly. And in fact, on our ranch, you know, in California, and probably this is probably true in New Mexico as well, but I know for sure in California there were believed to have been 18 of these megafauna, and they included a lot of big grazing animals like, I mean, actually, two different types of elephants, which are both grazers. They have a number of impacts, but they do grazing, and they do a lot of trampling in the same way that grazing animals do. There were camels here. There were lots of big grazing animals, but there were also lots of predators here. There were two different types of lions. There was a big tiger. There were bears. Lots of animals that are no longer here, and they were having a lot of impacts in various different ways. But the role of the predators is really important, and that's, I think, actually that's almost maybe the key of what's been missing in a lot of modern approaches to grazing. You know, we've kind of extirpated the predator population through human action, and unfortunately the ranching community has been a part of that problem, and that what that does is, in you know, it kind of minimizes the extent to which you're going to have impacts with your animals, your domesticated animals, in a similar way to how that would have been done historically. So I'm not advocating for, you know, trying to raise the predator numbers up to where they were historically, although I do believe in protecting predators and having them be part of these ecosystems. But what I really think we need to do is, through the use of herding techniques, the use of livestock guardian dogs, those are extremely helpful. We have two of those here on our ranch. Electric fencing, more human oversight. You know, there are lots of different factors that need to come into play to try to recreate conditions that are more similar to what would have been here for large grazing animals. And then basically through that approach, making the animals function more like the wild animals would have.
One of the themes running through your book is that the closer we do agriculture to the way nature works, the better it is for everybody. And that goes for both raising crops and for ranching and everything else. And there are so many ways you do this. And the effect of having an ecosystem approach and having, for example, the soil covered with plants rather than bare soil actually has a significant impact on climate change. Can you talk about that?
Yes, there are, and I would say really all environmental issues. I mean, that really is, you know, I kind of have jokingly said a few times that the real thesis of my book, just if I had to sum it down in one word, is grass, although I could say soil. It's one or the other of those. But I say grass because really the whole impact of whatever we do in terms of food production, whether, as you say, whether it's crop production or other, goes back to this question of how much we're disturbing the vegetation that's covering the earth, and then what's being disturbed as far as the soil organisms and the soil life that's beneath the surface. And the reason why grass is so important is because it is probably almost the optimal situation ecologically, both in terms of creating, generating, protecting the soils and sequestering carbon, and in terms of supporting all the other life in the ecosystem. And the reason for that is because it both holds the soil and makes this sort of healthy below-ground environment, but it also holds the water. And, you know, water is the other essential component in, you know, in all ecosystems for all of the life that's there. It all needs water. And the longer you hold water in an ecosystem, the better it is for all of the life that's there, the plant life and the animal life. From when you look at climate change, a lot of the issue is to do with the carbon. So grass is covering covers about 40% of the earth, and it is actually the single biggest solar collector in the earth are the grasses that cover the earth. And what they do, essentially, grasses take the carbon in the process of photosynthesis. They take the carbon that's in the atmosphere. It comes into the plant, and then it basically goes out through the roots. I mentioned the existence of this substance called glomalin. So it's with the assistance of fungi that live on the roots and the substance called glomalin, which is quite a newly discovered substance. And there are these various different exchanges that are happening in the soil between various different components and involving a lot of different microorganisms. But essentially, it's bringing nutrients into the plant in exchange for giving up the carbon. So the plant is like a mediator. It takes the carbon from the atmosphere and deposits it in the soil. So when you have grasslands, and especially well-functioning grasslands, which, you know, I argue in my book, you really need these big grazing animals to have these optimally functioning grasslands, they represent a huge opportunity for carbon sequestration. So there's a lot of talk about climate change, especially related to cattle and beef, you know, in the food system. I mean, there are many impacts, climate-related impacts from the entire food system. But the issue that seems to get the most attention in the public discussion is beef. And what's important to note is that the carbon sequestration potential with grazing animals, and, you know, especially cattle because of their size. I mean, they have a big impact, both negative or positive, depending on how they're managed. They have they really represent the opportunity for massive carbon sequestration that could be, there is carbon sequestration happening all the time in grasslands, but it could be dramatically improved with better management. And that's actually one of the few strategies that has been come up with to actually reduce climate change gases. So, you know, rather than just a lot of the focus in modern, you know, discussion about climate change is just trying to stop the increase of emissions. But this actually represents the opportunity to reverse the impacts of climate change. And I just want to quickly note, too, that you sometimes hear really wildly inflated figures about the climate impact of cattle, and sometimes it's even said in sort of the, you know, modern discussion you hear in the streets that over half of the global warming gases are from cattle. That's just completely untrue. The official figures in the United States from the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and these are the figures that were just used in Lima, Peru, for the international climate change, you know, negotiations, because I looked them up from their website for those negotiations. They're using these figures, the current figures. It says that all of agriculture represents is about 8% of global warming gases in the United States, and of that, cattle are about a quarter of it. So, or I should say all grazing animals. So that actually includes bison and sheep and goats and dairy cattle. It includes all of the ruminants, but their impact is about a quarter. So that means it's about 2% of the global warming gases in the United States are from ruminant animals. So it's not that that's not an important number. It is, but people have wildly inflated figures that they tend to use in conversation, and those are not scientifically based at all.
We're talking to Nicolette Hahn-Nyman about her book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. When we talk about climate change and global warming and soil and grass and cattle and croplands, one of the things that I think has really not been understood very well is what happens to grassland when you plow it and convert it into cropland. The climate change impact of that is very serious.
Right. In fact, I have a quote in my book from the great Wes Jackson, who's one of the kind of great agricultural thinkers of our day, maybe, you know, one of the very greatest of the world, probably. And he talks about the single biggest impact that humans have had on the globe being the plow. And in fact, he says in his book, New Roots for Agriculture, he says that even a very badly managed ranch has a much less devastating impact on the environment than a typical plowed field. Now, the reason for that is because when you plow, you scrape off that vegetation, and we were just talking about the importance of the roots and the importance of the plant and all the things that protect and cover the ground and keep the soil in place, but also foster this whole economy that's going on below ground. When you plow, you're scraping up all that vegetation, and you're just basically, you know, it's like Armageddon for the below ground environment. So you really cannot create the same kind of situation in a plowed field that you can do in a permanent, especially a permanent pasture or rangeland. Temporary pastures are good as well, but not quite as good. So basically, from a climate change perspective, this goes back again to this below ground functioning and the importance of what the vegetation is doing. And if you are plowing soil, there's a lot of research showing that plowing is very disruptive in terms of, it basically causes all the carbon to be released. And I was talking about the encapsulation of carbon a few minutes ago. And when you have a grassland or an undisturbed pasture or rangeland, it's actually been shown that the carbon can be stable in that environment for a century or more. Whereas if you were to sequester carbon in a crop field, which you could do, I mean, there's a way that you could foster carbon sequestration in a crop field while your crop is growing. But once you replanted, and especially if you plowed, you would just release that carbon back out into the atmosphere, or much of it. So part of what people, you know, very often overlook, I would say more often than not in these conversations, is that in order to have optimally functioning soils, you really want to have this grass covering and this undisturbed ground. And really the only way to raise food from that kind of land is with grazing animals. And in fact, I talk about in my book the fact that about probably 85%, it's estimated, of the lands the world over that are being grazed by animals are not usable for crop production at all. So not only, you know, is there an opportunity for sort of good ecological functioning using these animals, but these are really places that couldn't be used for food production anyways. So these are elements of the conversation that I think are usually absent.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I am a several times failed vegetarian. I've never been able to adapt to that way of eating or living because I just apparently need that kind of animal protein. But I always thought that it was my failure and I'd be a better person if I would just eat only vegetables. And you see that, you know, I'm beginning to see both through your book and through other work that's going on in this area that there is genuinely sustainable meat production, not only beef, but hogs and chickens and turkeys and all kinds of things. And, I mean, fish is out of the purview of this conversation because that's another conversation about the oceans. But this idea that if we all stop eating beef or stop eating meat, that we will be able to feed more people in the world, that we'll have a more sustainable world, that's really very much called into question now.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think there's a lot of reexamination of that idea. And, you know, I go through it in some detail in my book, sort of taking apart that whole argument. I mean, just as a lawyer, you know, to me, the argument doesn't make sense just on its face, because if it were true that by eating meat, let's say even from a factory farm. Okay, let's just say worst possible, you know, scenario. You're eating badly produced meat that's having all kinds of ecological problems. But let's say that you stopped doing that. If you try to think about what the chain of events that your action would affect is, and then you figure out how that's actually going to foster production of other food that's then going to go to hungry people. There are so many links in that chain that do not exist. You know, as a lawyer, to me, it's really obvious. When something, even if it were true that chain of events is correct, you know, that eating meat takes food away from hungry people, which I don't agree with, but let's say that were true for just a second. If you stopped doing that action, would it reverse that problem? And the answer to that is very obviously no, because would any of the land that was being used to, let's say, grow the crops that are fed to the grain-fed animals, let's say, would that then go to raising crops that would then feed hungry people? I mean, there are so many reasons why that would not happen. I mean, you know, we live in a world where people own land, where they have control over what is produced on it and where they're going to produce what's profitable. And the problem, I talk about this in some detail in the book, the world has been producing and currently produces far more food than we actually need to feed the world's population. Well over, when you add up the number of calories of food that are produced, it's far more than what's needed to produce the current population. And yet we have about 900 million hungry people in the world. And so it's very clear, and there are many, many good studies that have been done on this, that feeding hungry people is not about producing more food. That's a real fallacy that you hear again and again repeated from, you know, sort of big agribusiness that wants to support more technology and, you know, things that increase production. That is not, that is absolutely clear to me, is not the problem, and it is definitely not the solution. It's also true that there's more and more really good evidence that the most sustainable form of agriculture is one where animals are part of the system. In two different ways. First, on grazing animals on the lands that are not usable for crop production, as we talked about. And there are lots of reasons why you cannot or should not raise crops on different areas of land. There might not be enough moisture. There might be too much slope in the land. You know, there are many different physical conditions to land that makes it unsuitable or unwise to grow crops on it. And then the other part of the puzzle is when you actually, in areas where you are farming, where you're growing crops, animals should be part of that diverse system. Because essentially, as you said in your earlier comment, I'm arguing that the optimal food system is one that tries to model nature's systems. And the more complexity that there is and the more diversity there is, the better that those systems function. And our entire system today is based on fossil fuels. We're basically creating all of the agricultural chemicals, you know, whether it's fertilizers or pesticides, fungicides, all the different chemicals that are used in agriculture are very fossil fuel intensive in terms of their production, and sometimes their actual inputs are based on fossil fuels. And so if you're thinking about an era in the future where we no longer have those fossil fuels, we really have to be thinking of other models. And so that's where this importance of animals comes back into play. Animals are, as I've been saying, they're a really important way of cycling nutrients, of adding fertility back into the soil, and having grazing animals as part of a rotation in a diversified system is a wonderful way to add fertility back to the soil, to rebuild soils, and actually to keep pests down as well. It does all the functions that chemicals do. It's not easy to do this, but it's absolutely doable, and there are more and more examples of this around the world. So I think animals absolutely are part of an optimal food system, both in terms of productivity and in terms of ecologically. And so I would agree, if somebody's concern is their ecological impact, to me, that's not a compelling reason to give up animal-based foods at all.
What changes in agricultural policy do you think would help to make the food system, both plants and animals, be more sustainable, be more healthy?
Well, one of the things, you know, I talked about, there's a very interesting there was a historical shift that was really interesting that I talk about. The second chapter of my book is called All Food is Grass. And basically, I talked about a really interesting history that I was not aware of until fairly recently, where sort of mid-20th century, there was beginning to be this whole body of research showing, and this was actually the U.S. government that was doing this. It was sort of post Dust Bowl era, right? We were trying to figure out, well, okay, what can we do? We really need to keep the soil in place. We need to rebuild soils. What can we do to protect soil? That was a lot of the focus, and to keep fertility in the earth and to make agriculture more regenerative. And It was being increasingly argued that grass was the essential element. In fact, I think it was in 1948, the agricultural yearbook for that year that USDA put out, the Department of Agriculture put out, was just called Grass. And the whole book was arguing that grasses are the key to a sustainable food system. And then what happened? Chemicals came in and kind of supplanted the whole thing. It was fascinating. You know, there was sort of this weird detour in history that wasn't seen a few decades earlier. There was chemicals became readily available and inexpensive after World War II. A lot of munitions plants that were built for World War II were actually converted into agricultural chemical plants. And apparently that's a fairly easy process to convert it that way. And so all of a sudden, that whole direction in agriculture that had been building for a couple of decades after the, sort of really dramatic problems with agriculture in the 1930s, that all of a sudden got redirected towards chemical, usage. And so all of a sudden, chemical fertilizers, which had actually been developed over 100 years earlier, but they weren't very commonly used. And then all of a sudden, they became the solution in agriculture. They became the way that fertility was created. They became the way that pests were dealt with, et cetera. And so I would argue we should return to the fostering of grass as the primary method for protecting soils, for rebuilding soils, for fostering carbon sequestration, and for, a lot of the things that we're currently relying on chemicals for today, because we know chemicals are not only are they, there's an exhaustible source, and it's being exhausted of fossil fuels, but also there are many negative impacts from using, there's been a ton written and said about that over the years, but using agricultural chemicals instead of more holistic methods has many negative downstream effects, including, the huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that's the size of the state of New Jersey. We know that there are many problems from using chemicals, and it's also being shown increasingly that these chemicals have a very negative effect on the soil biology. So I've mentioned glomalin a few times. One of the things about glomalin that's been discovered is that the application of synthetic nutrients to the soils is damaging to glomalin production. So there are all kinds of, downstream negative effects to using chemicals. So I believe that in terms of what policies we need to have policies that shift agriculture away from reliance on the chemicals and more towards diversity, encourages the use of grass and, for many different purposes, and encourages sort of these relationships between plants and animals that are essential for truly sustainable food production. There's very little right now in modern agricultural policy in the United States that does any of that. In fact, it sort of pushes things in the opposite direction. So I think there's a lot of room for federal policy having a very dramatic beneficial effect. That being said, I don't see very much hope for any of that happening out of Washington in the near future. And so I really am looking at consumers and farmers and ranchers as the much more important actors in this whole issue, because I think we're seeing this dramatic rise in interest in farmers and ranchers and being, more ecological in their practices. And we're seeing a dramatic rise in interest among consumers in eating better food and food that they know more about as far as the history of it and that is cleaner, as far as what might be in it in terms of the food chain. So I think that I don't look that much to Washington to be very helpful on this issue.
No, but I mean, in the long run, what it looks like from everything you're saying is that eventually we would want to make a transition from gigantic industrially farmed monocrop lands and industrial livestock production to ecologically based, probably smaller scale production, but lots of it.
Yes, I mean, I do think that, you know, when you look at the role that federal policy has had over the last century, it has had dramatic impact. You know, it was really, you know, there's that great documentary that Ken Burns did about the Dust Bowl, and you see the federal government in there sort of coming in, including the president, coming in and firsthand going around and speaking to farmers in the Dust Bowl areas. And, you know, and FDR is out there making speeches to people. And, I mean, it was the government played a dramatic role in addressing that and, in fact, did very good work. And it's kind of shocking when you look at that part of American history right now, because Washington seems so paralyzed and so inept and so incapable of sort of making dramatic shifts in, you know, the way the country is functioning, including in agriculture. But it's true. Having the government, you know, on this path would be incredibly useful and important. And I think that probably, you know, Congress and you know, the regulatory agencies will eventually come along. It seems to me that the people need to lead on this, because there's so much influence in Washington from the vested interests that affect agriculture. And I would consider sort of the chemical industry, the processed food industry, you know, agribusiness industry, and the drug industry, all as really important players that don't want to see dramatic changes happen in the way agriculture is done today. Actually, not to mention the fossil fuel industry, actually, because they gain a lot from, you know, our fossil fuel-based agricultural system. So I think it's going to take this sort of revolution at the grassroots level, and then I think you'll eventually see Washington coming along, hopefully sooner rather than later. But yes, it's true. If the government were part of the solution, it could be very, very helpful. I'm just not that optimistic that that's going to happen.
Grassroots level, no pun intended.
Yes, exactly.
So let's talk about for a moment, I mean, here we are in New Mexico, where some people are doing terrific land management practices, and there's been horrible land management and overgrazing and just bare earth with barely anything on it, and these cows walking around looking sort of forlorn. How do you address that when you've got land that has been so badly degraded? It doesn't seem that the land will restore itself if left alone, or will it?
No, I don't think leaving land alone is the best approach. And in fact, it's interesting, the term overgrazing is used a lot when people talk about degraded areas, whether you're talking about the American West or other parts of the world. And I talk a lot about the wildlife ecologist Alan Savory in my book, who he's been working on land restoration issues for several decades all around the globe. And he argues that actually land is almost never overgrazed. It's improperly grazed, because he actually feels that these, you know, he's one of the lead proponents of this idea that the animal impacts are essential. But he is in agreement that there's very degraded land in the American West due to the action that cattle are having on it. You know, so he would say that is not overgrazed land, that is improperly grazed land. And the reason that's an important distinction is because that suggests that it's not necessarily, in fact, I believe it definitely is not the right solution to take the animals off of that land. It's really a question of addressing how those cattle are managed on that land. And in fact, you know, as I was talking about earlier, I believe that you won't get an optimal functioning ecosystem without those animals. So you really don't want to try to get rid of the animals. You really want to focus on managing them better. And as you said, there's fantastic work being done in many parts of the American West, including Mexico, of showing how that can be done. Because it's a relatively new idea, you know, that you manage them in a very particular way to you know, protect the soils and the vegetation. And, I mean, I think there's good sustainable grazing practices that have been done in various parts of the world for a very long time. But there's also been a lot of bad grazing that's taken place. And I think as cattle ranchers and other people involved with livestock, it's important that we acknowledge that because if we simply deny that there's a link there, you know, that's first of all, it's just not true, but it really damages our credibility. I mean, there are many impacts that take place when you have animals on land, especially cattle, because they're big, heavy animals. But when properly managed, those impacts are not only beneficial, they're essential. So I think taking animals off the land is not the right answer at all. It's really about management. And I think that's a place where I think government can and should and realistically could have an active role. So I don't see government as doing anything very dramatic, especially coming out of Washington. But I've been encouraging people, friends of mine in California, that we should really think about approaching our governor, Jerry Brown, about promoting sustainable grazing training and offering this, you know, to all ranchers in the state of California as a way to mitigate climate change and drought. And I think the same would definitely be true for New Mexico, that if that were being offered, I think a lot of ranchers would take it. I mean, especially if they didn't have to pay anything for it, right? If this were being provided. And there are agricultural extension agents all over the United States. And so there are people that, you know, are already in place that could be part of this solution.
Now, your life changed dramatically from being a lawyer to basically living on a ranch and having that be your life. How do you like your new, it's not so new anymore, but how do you like your life compared to the old one?
Well, you know, it's funny, but I went from, you know, literally living in the middle of Manhattan and getting a manicure every 2 weeks and wearing high heels like 6 days a week to living on a ranch in Northern California, and I haven't had a manicure in several years and never wear heels pretty much. And so my life, it's been a very big shift. But to me, I really just look at these as, you know, sort of all chapters in my life. And I'm very glad I've had the time living. I've lived in a number of urban areas, not just New York, but I'm glad I've had those experiences. I think those were really valuable and interesting parts of my life. And I'm very, very glad to be where I am today. Especially because I was one of those kids that grew up outdoors and just was outside looking at bugs and leaves and, you know, all kinds of things that you find in, you know, outside, looking under the rocks, you know. I was doing that all day, every day in my childhood. And you know, and that was the era where, you know, parents let their kids be outside unsupervised, you know, after a certain age. So for me, I think I always needed that physical presence in the natural world. And actually, when I lived in Manhattan, the whole time I lived in Manhattan, which was about 5 years, I always lived deliberately near Central Park, you know, so I could sort of get out there and be among trees and rocks and flowers and, you know, bugs and all that stuff. I really feel like I need that every day. So being on a ranch now has been just a wonderful sort of reconnection with, you know, being out and being amongst the wild animals and the domesticated animals at the same time. And for me, it's kind of the optimal life. I mean, I'm incredibly happy that I'm here, and we have two young sons now, and I'm so grateful that I'm able to give them that experience every day. It's something that few children, unfortunately, you know, get to experience nowadays. So I'm very, very happy to, you know, that my life has taken this course. Yeah. Not something I would have necessarily been able to predict, but something I'm very, very happy about.
Now, are you still a vegetarian?
I am.
Amazing.
Well, it for me, it kind of boils down to this. I started being a vegetarian more than 25 years ago, and it was, you know, I mentioned it was, you know, my freshman year in college, and I just thought it was the right thing to do. And over the last, you know, 25 years, I've been eating vegetarian consistently. I've always stayed vegetarian. I never wavered from that. And so it's just really the way I eat. I was talking with someone else about this the other day, and he was saying almost the exact same thing. He's been a vegetarian for a long time, but he said he's kind of realized that if you raise animals the right way, it can be ecologically beneficial. And yet he's just in the habit of not eating meat, and that's what he's comfortable with. And I said, God, that is exactly the way it is for me. So I think right now, you know, we have these two young boys, and I feed them animal products, including meat, every single day. I really believe that it's part of a healthy diet, but at the same time, I don't believe you must eat it. And so I think it's a matter of individual choice based on what people are comfortable with. Obviously, I encourage people to buy, you know, the best possible foods that they can find, and especially animal-based foods, to be from grass and hopefully from local farmers and ranchers, so that you really know how it's produced. And that's how we get all of our meat and things that we don't raise ourselves, we get from farmers that we know. And so I take a lot of care, you know, in the sourcing of those foods. But I think they're very beneficial to the human body. And if I ever feel the urge to eat meat again, I will definitely do so.
Nicolette Han Nyman is author of the book Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, the Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was truly my pleasure.